So without further ado, Ron.
I took a picture of you guys. You know, at NASA, we're really big into records and doing firsts and stuff. So I might, correct me if I'm wrong, but I might be the first astronaut to ever take a picture of a tweet up and send it out during a tweet. All right, so how does this work? I've never been to one of these before. Really. I've been virtually, but not for real. Here at the Kennedy Space Center supporting the launch activities for Discovery, which is pretty cool to be able to see it right there out on the pad. Had the really great fortune of riding on Discovery about 2.5 years ago with the International Space Station, and it was really an exciting time. So why don't we just open up the questions? Is that what you guys want to do?
Sure.
Okay.
Please wait for the microphone.
Okay,
that's the question.
All right, Beth wants me to tell you guys that in March, I'm gonna be spending 6 months, I'm gonna launch on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan and spend 6 months on the International Space Station. And for the last 2 years, I've been training for that event. I've been trying to document as much as I could on Twitter and also on the website where we started, fragileoasis.org. And really looking forward to that. So, okay, questions?
Yeah, hi, thanks so much. Actually, I just tweeted you a little bit ago, and Don Stugatz from Twitter asked me a question. He wanted to know, do astronauts still drink Tang?
Astronauts still drink Tang. We drink an orange drink. I don't know what it's called, but we have lots of different flavored drinks, and basically we have our little bags filled with powdered drink stuff, and we plug it into the galley and fill it up with water and shake it up, and it's like a little juice box with a straw. So I don't think we call it Tang anymore. Oh, there they are. Hey. So, this one is a mango peach smoothie, tea with lemon and sugar. We got a bunch of these. Other questions, who's next?
Hi, @TaylorLarson. A friend on Facebook asked me to ask you. She said, my daughter is 4 months old with a crib full of rockets and stars. Realistically speaking, and assuming she has the physical and intellectual requirements met, safe assumption for this doting mother, she asked, how realistic will it be for her if she wants to shoot for the moon and become an astronaut or rocket scientist in 2030?
I think it's realistic for anybody to shoot for the moon, anybody to follow their dreams. It's you know, I always encourage everybody who has a dream to follow it, because, you know, when I'm asked the question of what does it take to become an astronaut, what advice can you give to become an astronaut, what I think is the most important thing, the most important piece of advice is to find something, you know, we'll talk to young kids, is to find something that you truly love to do and to be the very, very best at whatever it is you choose to do, because we have astronauts that are from every walk of life practically, that obviously pilots and engineers and scientists, but we also have chemists and veterinarians and teachers and, you know, a bunch of different walks of life. So what all those people had in common is they went into a profession that they really loved and really enjoyed doing and excelled at it. And so that's my biggest piece of advice. But, you know, having said that, I don't also want to say that no dream is too big to dream and nothing is impossible. And I'm really, really impressed with the younger generations that are doing amazing things, and, you know, they haven't learned the word impossible yet. And so I applaud them, and I'm humbled by them, and I learned from them by watching the amazing things that some of the young generations are doing these days. Yes.
Midlife road trip, and what we do is we live out our bucket list. And you've done everything, so what's on your bucket list?
What's on my bucket list? There's a lot of things that I'd like to do. I don't know if I'll actually get to do them, but one of the things, I don't know if I can call this a bucket list, but one of the things that I really want to do is, you know, we have a lot of objectives on our mission that we're going to have on the International Space Station. And they're great objectives, and we're going to do a lot of great science, and we're going to you know, expand the boundaries of space exploration. But from a personal objective, what I want to do is I want to use that orbital perspective, that special gift that we've been given to see the Earth from space, and to hopefully use that to inspire people to improve our planet and to do things on a planet that makes life better for everybody. I think, you know, if I could check that off the bucket list when I'm done with my 6-month mission, I'll personally consider that a success. Obviously, you know, all the mission objectives that are the formal mission objectives, which what I just described is always a formal mission objective, but it's just something that I, you know, really want to take to heart while I'm up there. So I enjoy coaching. I'd like to coach football, high school football someday maybe. I enjoy teaching. I'd like to maybe either volunteer or work, you know, work in a school district maybe someday. So those are things on my bucket list.
You want a question out here, right over here. Please remember to wave the microphone. You are on a Ustream right now. Thank you.
Good, I hope so. I'm at Katie James on Twitter. I understand that, we're having to wait a couple days for the launch, but also having to wait are the astronauts. And they're in quarantine right now. And since you've been there, if you could tell us a little bit about what they're going through, where are they in relation to where we are, how strict is the quarantine, what does it involve? Basically, what is their mindset right now, and what are they doing to get ready?
I was very, very fortunate not to ever experience a launch lift as a crew member. We went on the beautiful Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock on the first attempt. Leading up to that, when you're not sure if you're going to launch, even right up to the moment of launch, I remember that was what I was thinking. You know, you've got all these people that have come from all over the country or all over the world to come see you launch, and if you don't launch today, a lot of them are going to be not being able to see you launch. So I know that's a big concern of the crew. I know that, every time there's a slip, they realize, more of the guests are going home. And in some cases, there was, a big sacrifice financially or kids taking kids out of school and all that kind of stuff. So I know that's a big factor weighing on the crew. Right now, they're just trying to keep their skills sharp. So Steve Lindsay and Eric Bowe are going to be flying the shuttle training aircraft to keep their landing skills. They may be flying T-38s if they choose to. The other crew members are looking at various things that they think are volatile skills that they don't want to lose. And they're in crew quarters, usually having last-minute classes and everything just to keep their skills and just relaxing, because they've had a very, very strenuous year-plus training period. And a lot of times, that's one of the most important things to do is to just have some downtime before a big, busy mission like that. And the Russians actually plan that. There's after the last test in Star City, before you go to Baikonur, they have a week of rest. And I think that's really important so that you're not launch fatigued. Am I picking, or somebody else picking?
Hey, David Glenn, BMS Science Guy. I'm one of the few teachers that are in the room, and we're going back to our students in a few days. And one of the activities we did to prepare the students for me coming down here was a activity where we talked about puppy head, bird leg syndrome, where you first go up initially into the microgravity environment. Can you talk a little bit about what the how your body reacted when you went up into outer space, and talk about the feelings and effects that you went through.
Okay, yeah. The human body is an absolutely amazing thing, and it adapts very rapidly to whatever environment it's put in. There's immediate adaptation and there's long-term adaptation, and actually some of that's not good. For instance, shortly after you get into space, your body realizes it doesn't need a skeleton anymore, and so it starts losing bone density. But the initial experience of going to space, it's a very violent change in environments. So you go from 3 Gs, so you've got an elephant standing on your chest pushing you into your seat, to 0 G in an instant. And you continue to be in 0 G for the duration of the mission until you come back to Earth. And so my body, I was a military test pilot, so I had a lot of experience in high performance aircraft. When I first got to 0G, it really wasn't that noticeable. I mean, it was a noticeable shock, the difference, but I felt like my body really adapted very, very quickly. However, I think my body at some point thought it was going to stop. It said, okay, I've experienced this before, it's zero G, but all the other times I've experienced it, it's been, you know, maybe 30 seconds at most, and now it's been an hour or 2 hours and it's still here. And then at some point my body said, this isn't right. Something's not right here. So there was a period on the first day where it was very difficult for my body to adjust. So I might go through maybe after a couple of hours, I'd have a period of maybe, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. Well, I have a period of maybe a minute where I start to feel nauseous, but then it would go away. And that continued for the whole first day, which was pretty soon thereafter we go to bed. So, but the next day I woke up and I felt fine, and I felt fine for the rest of the mission. But it is a really interesting transition, and the transition is equally as difficult for some people to go from 0G to 1G when you come back. And, you know, a lot depends on that, the body type, how long you've been in space, etc. But I remember when I came back to Earth, it took me quite a bit of time to figure out how to walk. I'd say for about 3 or 4 hours, I had to really think about, even though I was only up there for 2 weeks, okay, here's my left foot, here's my right foot, I'm starting to lean right, I need to come back left. And so I had to consciously do that. And when you crawl out of the space shuttle, and you crawl into this little area where you can change out of your spacesuit and into your flight suit, right before we went down and walked down the steps to do a walk around on the runway of the orbiter, the flight surgeons said, you know, whatever you do, don't look up at the tiles when you get underneath the orbiter. And I forgot that they told me that when I was underneath the orbiter, and I looked up, because you want to see the tiles, that's what just saved your life, and it's really cool, and you want to see if anything is burned off, and you just saw this flame going by the window, and you want to see how the bottom of the orbiter did. But as soon as I started going back there, I immediately remembered, okay, this is why they told me not to do this, because your whole body wants to just keep going. But I didn't, I caught myself, but there really is a big adjustment period. Long answer to a short question, sorry.
Andrew from Chicago. Just a quick question. Since you've had the experience of being both on the shuttle and now you're training for the Soyuz capsule, what's been the biggest challenge you've seen in transitioning to a capsule flight?
Yeah, what's the biggest difference transition to a capsule? I don't think that was a big transition. I mean, it's a lot smaller volume. You know, you're a lot more cramped in there. So you have to think about where you place things and body position and everything else. So that's certainly the case. But I think the biggest challenge for me was the language. Because, you know, the official language of the space station is English, but the official language of the Soyuz is Russian. And so to be in a very dynamic environment like launch or re-entry, and to do that all in a non-native language, so it takes a lot of work. And so that, I think, is probably one of the biggest challenges for me. And continues to be.
Hi, my name is Chris Jantz. I think most of us here, our whole lifetime, we've watched manned spaceflight. And so now we're coming to a period in our history of our space program where we're going to have kind of a lull in that amount of time. How do we keep kids inspired and going after engineering and astrophysics and aeronautics and keep that active in the kids' minds when they may not be seeing it on TV?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I'm going to have a good answer for it, but I'll tell you how it affected me personally. I wanted to be an astronaut since July 20th, 1969, when I saw the first moon landing as a really, really young kid. But that was a dream that I carried throughout most of my childhood until I got into high school. And when I was in high school, as far as I knew, our nation didn't have a space program because it was after Skylab, it was before the space shuttle started flying. And, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I went to college and I just started taking whatever it was I was taking, you know, general studies for the most part. And so STS-1 happened. And when STS-1 happened, the light bulb came back on and said, oh, wait a minute, we do have a space program. And literally the next day, I went to my advisor and signed up for math and science courses. I started pursuing a degree in aerospace engineering. And so that had a big effect on my motivation for education. So what do we do when we stop flying shuttles? We're not going to stop flying the space station. So we're still going to have astronauts in space. They're just You know, we won't have an American vehicle for a few years to get them there and back. But I think maybe one of the challenges to the young kids is, hey, help us do that. You know, we've got a shortfall here. We know all the help we can get. You know, maybe use that as a way, you know, we're faced with this challenge. You know, how can we overcome this challenge? You know, how can we design something that will work better than we had before? And when we're done with that challenge, there's going to be this, you know, there'll be Mars and beyond and all these other challenges. And, you know, we're not going to be the ones doing it. The kids are going to be doing it. So we need all the help we can get. So it's a tough question. Thanks.
Hi. Question. Are you going to take over the whole role of tweeting from space and sending out those really cool pictures up there?
Yeah, I'm gonna try. You know, Wheels is a pretty hard act to follow. Those are some great pictures, and Scott's sending out some good pictures too. I plan on taking as many pictures as I can and sending them down. And I don't know if I'll be as good a photographer as those guys are, but I'll try.
Okay. Next question: can you tweet upside down?
You can tweet upside down or right side up. Or, I don't think. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it might not matter. So thanks.
Earlier, you mentioned a very dynamic individual on the launch and re-entry, and Alaska has lost insight in space and for the launch net, which you launch the entry, you don't see a lot. Can you give us a little bit of a perspective of what you go through as a crew as an individual on both launch and re-entry?
Okay, what our experience is as a crew on launch and entry. Okay. That's an interesting point. I mean, that's going to be very dependent on the crew member. But I remember when I was training, I trained for about 8 years before I flew my first mission to space. And whenever we were in the simulator, we were laying on our back and, you know, getting ready to, you know, the countdown was going, getting ready to launch. I always projected myself into that moment where I was going to be doing it for real. And I always would get, you know, little butterflies in my stomach and feel a little nervous about it. And, but on the day of launch, I actually really felt calm. We had trained for so long, and you know, everything, you knew exactly what was going to happen, hopefully, and, you know, you were just totally focused on the job that you had to accomplish to get into orbit. It's the same thing on the way back, but on the way back, though, you know, you're filled with this excitement and maybe a little bit of anxiety that you have this really complicated mission that's going to be very, very challenging, and it's all in front of you, and the first event is going to be pretty spectacular to get you there. So, you know, there's that excitement. On the way back, you know, you still have a lot to do, and there's still a lot of danger involved, but you have that whole mission behind you. And so part of it is, you know, a really big sense of accomplishment that, you know, you just made the space station bigger, and you know, thanks to the thousands of people, you know, the thousands of people who worked, you know, in some cases for decades to get this part of the space station up there and working, that we're counting on you not to mess it up. And it's all there and it's working, so that, you know, pretty big sense of accomplishment. So I hope that answers your question.
We want to talk for two more questions. There's one over there, and I'll take one over here, and then we need to wrap with Ron, unfortunately.
Okay, so I'm Jason Preston. This might be a slightly odd question, but stick with me for a second. The only thing I can think compared to like free fall and all that is roller coasters. I love roller coasters. They're slightly addictive. Do you feel like, having gone to space, I mean, obviously you're going back, do you feel compelled physically to return? Is that an experience that is somehow, I don't know, addictive or, you know, as an experience to the human body? I don't know how you feel, and then maybe if you can generalize how you think other astronauts have felt about going back to space.
Yeah, I am very much looking forward to going back to space. It's a really, really special and unique place. You know, because I am going back to space, you know, I don't have this sense that you know, I'm sure when I land in the Soyuz in Kazakhstan a year from now, almost, you know, I'm gonna really think to myself, wow, this is probably the last time I'm gonna do this. I'm never gonna see this again. I'm never gonna experience this again, and it's gonna be, you know, we're melancholy there, I guess, but, you know, I'm really looking forward to, you know, renewing that experience, and in a different way this time, because when I went there last time, I was there for 2 weeks. It was a really jam-packed mission,
we had time to enjoy it and to realize that we're in a very, very unique and special place. But it's going to be a lot different to be there for 6 months. And so it's a difference between visiting space and living in space. And so that's something that I'm really looking forward to basically, you know, become an inhabitant of somewhere outside of Earth. And I know I'm going to miss the beauty of the Earth. It's just absolutely breathtaking. I'm going to miss looking down at the Earth and seeing the difference between night and day, looking down on the surface of the Earth, and realize everybody over on this side is asleep in bed and everybody over here is at work, and seeing the moon rise from orbit, you know, on the horizon. So there's a lot of these images, some of them which I haven't even seen yet, you know, that I'm sure I don't even know about yet, that I'm going to see. And you know, there's little snapshots that I remember from my last mission, like flying over massive lightning storms and things like that, where you just are sitting there going, I'm the only person in the world that's seeing this right now, or me and my crewmates are the only people in the world that are seeing like this, and there's no way to describe it. And so when we no longer have that ability, it's going to be, you know, kind of sad. But as long as I feel like I made the unbelievable privilege I've been given, as long as I'm able to make the best of that and to be able to share that as best I can with everybody else, you know, I think I'll feel satisfied that I did what I should have done.
Cool. I guess I get the last question. Steve Russler at Govloop. I got a question. You're obviously a really busy man doing really important stuff. When a lot of people hear the word Twitter, they're like, I'm too busy. That's a waste of time. Why do you use Twitter, and how do they convince you that this is important to your mission and NASA's mission?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm glad you asked it, because I started using Twitter because I saw it as a way to do education outreach. And I am using it for education outreach, but I'm using it for more. Once I started using it, I realized that there was more use to it than just that. And what I mean by that is, you know, I can send out a tweet that says, I'm working on this or that experiment with a link, and then, you know, students or classrooms that are interested in that can follow the link. But I see it more, I mean, in addition to that, I see that it's also a way that I could fulfill that other objective that I talked about, is helping other people experience the unique opportunity, the unique experience of flying in space and seeing the Earth and all the things that we get to do as astronauts. You know, I feel a big responsibility to share that with other people, and this is a wonderful vehicle to be able to do that, especially, you know, when we can send down pictures from space or movies from space. So I hope that answers your question. It's really interesting. And I'm going to use Twitter the other way too, because I'm going to have some Twitter sites that I follow, and I'm going to say, you know, send these up to me, please. And if there's links in there that I want to see, then I'll ask them, hey, can you send me these links? We do have the internet on board, but it's really right now it's not fast enough to be usable, I don't think. And so we're still reliant on, you know, what we call mail syncs, where we send out emails and get emails back. And so I'm going to use Twitter to get some of my news on board too, and to follow some of the things that I enjoy following.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you for being here.